Okay, this is William Fink of ChrisDeGhenney.org, and this is ChrisDeGhenney Internet Radio. I'm sorry I'm so in such sad shape this evening. I've had so many computer problems the last 20 minutes. I don't know if I'm coming or going. With two computers, not just with one, I couldn't get my laptop, which is brand new, which is all configured properly. And it was told me I was connected to the stream, and the stream metadata told me I was live because I watched the control panel on a stream on a remote server, but there was no sound coming out. So I don't even know what's up with that. But this Windows 10 computer that I always stream on every week seems to be really shaky. This evening, I click on an icon like six times. With 30 seconds or 45 seconds in between, nothing happens. And all of a sudden, six copies of the program open at once. So that's just fun and games. That's Microsoft Windows, I guess. It sucks. It's terrible. It's extremely unreliable, in my opinion. Okay. This evening, we're going to present Or we're going back to our Exodus presentation. There's one thing I want to say before we begin. This interview I played last week, which was also late. It was also started late because of a stream malfunction. But this interview with Mark Collette of the Patriotic Alternative group in Britain that I did last week, I posted it in audio and in video, and it, which I usually do. There's a lot of people that commute or they're truck drivers that can't really watch videos, so whenever I post a video, I try to post the audio with it. Well, the video turned 50,000 downloads this afternoon, and the audio's at about almost 4,800. So praise Yahweh, that's incredible to me. I don't know why that particular podcast is such a draw. I didn't know Mark was so popular here in the States. I don't think he is really. I don't know, but that's a lot of downloads that for the first week at ChrisDeGhenney. That's more than I'm pretty sure that's more than I've ever had before. We have podcasts that are well into the hundreds of thousands of downloads, but it took years for those podcasts to get to that point. So praise Yahweh for that. This is Highlights in Exodus, and this is the plagues of Egypt. We won't get through quite all of the plagues of Egypt this evening. I'm saving the last plague, the plague of the loss of the firstborn sons, for our next installment in Exodus. Otherwise, this might be 12 or 13,000 words, right? It's too much. I'm sorry. I couldn't quite get it. This is, I hope it's going to be interesting and not boring, because I'm comparing a couple of large sections of the Wisdom of Solomon and what Solomon said about these same plagues. So, in our last segment of Highlights in Exodus, the confrontation. Moses had finally accepted his commission from Yahweh, and returning to Egypt, he met with Aaron along the way. And with that meeting, it is important to observe the fact that they had met at Sinai, the mountain of God. And by that we know that the Mount Sinai of the Exodus was in the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula, and could not have been far from the common route that was between Midian and Egypt, the land of Midian and the land of Egypt. We know this because Moses had embarked on a routine journey with his family to return to Egypt, where no precautions had made it necessary to use any alternate routes, And the common route would have been the most comfortable, as there had been at least one inn where he had stopped along the way. Likewise, Aaron was sent by Yahweh to meet Moses on his way. So Aaron also must have taken the common route and traveled until he encountered him coming in the opposite direction. With this simple understanding of this chapter, Exodus chapter 5, I think it was, all of the insane theories about the location of Sinai having been in the extremely mountainous southern part of the peninsula are entirely discredited. Understanding this chapter, understanding where Moses had met Aaron, understanding how he traveled to get there, the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, the interior is barren. It's very mountainous. It's barren. Even to this day, there's only a couple of little tiny dots with names on Google Maps in the interior of the southern part of the Sinai, and there's very few coastal towns compared to the rest of the Mediterranean area or the rest of the area of the Levant and Egypt. There are very few coastal towns. There's a couple of resorts. There's an airport all the way in the south. They're right on the coast. Nothing's in the mountains to speak of. They didn't march millions of people through those mountains in the Exodus. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that they did. That being said, just reading that narrative of Aaron meeting Moses at Sinai and Moses having traveled roads with inns along the way, we know that it's in the northern part on the customary routes that were typically traveled by travelers, traders, merchants, whatever, between Midian and Egypt. The popular routes, or route, I should say. Now we shall discuss the plagues of Egypt. But first, we shall have a presentation of a section of the Wisdom of Solomon. This is because many Bible commentators have, for a long time, connected these plagues of Egypt to the idols of ancient Egypt. And they often attest that Yahweh is mocking the idols of the Egyptians by having natural phenomena related to their own idols turn against them. Those connections are highly creditable, and to a great extent, I agree, and I will agree throughout this evening. But far too often, those commentators do not reveal the original source of that assessment. They leave that part out of their commentaries. They don't give credit where it's due, and credit is due to the wisdom of Solomon. In his wisdom, Solomon made that exact association as the greater scope of the work compared the fate of the impious, for which Egypt was an example, with the fate of the pious, for which, of course, the children of Israel were his example. So speaking of idolatry and the making of idols in Wisdom chapter 15, that chapter closes where Solomon wrote, "And they worship the most loathsome animals. For being compared in folly, it is the worst of all others," similar to what Paul said in Romans chapter 1. "Neither is it so much as to be desired that the sight of a beast attains beauty, but escapes even the approval of God and his blessing." And I would say that Yahweh created beasts and they were good. And some of them are graceful and attractive, but they were not made to be beautiful so that they may be venerated. Most beasts are just plain ugly and are certainly not candidates for any object of veneration. So as he had proceeded, in chapter 16, Solomon described the fact that the Egyptians had been punished with their own idols, but in contrast, Israel had been granted mercy in the wilderness. Israel was rescued by beasts. The Egyptians, because they worshipped their beasts, were punished with them. Where we read from verse 1 of Wisdom chapter 16, and we will read much of this chapter. Therefore, on account of these same things, they are punished worthily and tormented by a multitude of beasts. Instead of which punishment, Solomon addressing God here, working kindly for your people, for their longing of appetite, you prepared quail mothers, meat of a strange taste, in order that they, on the one hand desiring food, on account of the ugly thing, sight of the thing sent upon them, then they would turn away from the necessity of appetite, while they having been a little needy, the Israelites, also then partakers of a strange taste, referring to the quail mothers. The King James Bible has quail in that verse in Exodus, where the Israelites had eaten quail that were sent to them when they demanded meat. But the word is actually a word that means quail mothers, and Solomon called it meat of a strange taste, the word in the Septuagint. So quail would not be meat of a strange taste. But these birds called quail mothers were actually a different species of bird that sort of traveled with the quail as they flocked and moved from place to place. And from what I remember correctly, if I remember it correctly, from my Wisdom of Solomon commentary 4 years ago, the quail mothers actually sort of led the way, but they were different birds than the quail. And they had to be because quail was commonly eaten in the ancient Near East, but quail mothers, no, not so much. So Solomon goes on to say, it was necessary for them that while unmerciful poverty came upon those ruling as tyrants, meaning the Egyptians, on the other hand, to these alone, the Israelites, it was shown how their enemies had been tormented. For even when a terrible wrath of beasts came upon them, and they were destroyed by the bites of the crooked serpents, the Israelites, your wrath did not abide to an end. But for an admonishment, they were troubled for a while, having a token of salvation, the bronze serpent in the wilderness, for a reminder of the commandment of your law. For he, having turned, was not saved by that thing having been seen, but by you, the Savior of all. Then even in this you had persuaded our enemies that you are the deliverer from every evil. Solomon is pointing out that these events in the Exodus, in the wilderness, in the book of Numbers, were an example to the children of Israel. When they were punished by beasts, they had an avenue to repent and turn to God, and they would be healed of their punishment. They would be alleviated. Whereas when the Egyptians were punished by beasts, it was for their idolatry, and there was no avenue out of it. They had no mercy. And the punishment of the children of Israel should have taught them that they would have mercy if they repented, where the Egyptians were offered no such lesson. they could have repented and perhaps not been punished so severely, but they wouldn't. Okay, they found no repentance. The Pharaoh found no repentance. And neither did the nobles, as we read the account of the plagues of Egypt. Continuing with chapter 16 of the Wisdom of Solomon, from verse 9, indeed for them, the Egyptians, the bites of grasshoppers and flies have killed. Now, there's nothing about the Egyptians dying from bites of grasshoppers and flies in the Exodus account, where those two plagues are in Exodus chapters 10 and 8. Grasshoppers 10, flies 8. But, and I'll discuss this later, evidently Solomon had more information than Moses had recorded in Exodus. And that's kind of indicated in the account in Exodus itself. Solomon continues, the bites of grasshoppers and flies have killed, and there has not been found a remedy for their life because they were worthy to be punished by such things. But your sons, not even the teeth of poisonous dragons, had overcome the flying serpents of the wilderness. For your mercy had permeated and healed them. And skipping ahead to verse 16. For refusing to know you, the impious, meaning the Egyptians, with the strength of your arm had been scourged, since it is most credible that the fire works more in the water, which extinguishes all things, for the order, or cosmos, or world, if you will, the order is a defender of the righteous. And here Solomon speaks of the plague of hail and fire upon Egypt, which is found in Exodus chapter 9. We will discuss that later this evening. Here he also says that the cosmos, the natural order or world in that same sense, is a defender of the righteous. And if Yahweh redeems Israel from its current captivity in the manner in which he had in ancient Egypt, we are also reminded of that in Revelation chapter 12. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman. The order is a defender of the righteous, according to Solomon. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. There is no doubt now that the flood, of the mouth of the serpent has come upon the woman, who represents the children of Israel. So his deliverance is awaited once again. Returning to Solomon, he described the fire and ice of the plague as having worked together to accomplish the justice of God. Verse 18 of the chapter. For indeed, at times the flame was softened, in order that it would not consume the creatures sent against the impious, sent against the Egyptians. But though seeing, they noted they were attacked by the judgment of God. And then another time, the flame of fire was capable beyond water, that it may destroy the produce of the unrighteous land. Instead of which, having fed your people the food of messengers, the food of angels, the manna in the desert, then you provided bread prepared from heaven for them without labor, prevailing for all pleasure and every agreeable taste. For indeed, your substance manifested your sweetness to the children and transformed itself to the desire of he taking it to himself, ministering to any who were willing. But snow and ice survived the fire and did not melt. in order that they would know that fire burning in the hell and flashing in the rain had destroyed the fruits of the enemies. That's a reference specifically to Exodus chapter 9, verse 24. Yet again, even this had forgotten its own strength in order that the righteous may be nourished. For the creation, which is serving you, the Maker, augments itself for punishment against those of the unrighteous and relaxes in kindness for the sake of those who are complying before you. On which account, at that time, also being transformed into all things within your all-nourishing gift, it had served for the favor of those in want, in order that your sons, O Yahweh, whom you love, may learn that it is not the productions of fruits which nourish a man, but your word which maintains those who are believing in you. Man shall not live by bread alone. Here we see it in the Wisdom of Solomon. For that which by fire is not destroyed, simply by a little ray of the sun being warmed was melted, so that it may be known that it is necessary to rise before the sun, for which to give you thanks, and to entreat you at the dawning of light. For the hope of the ungrateful shall melt as wintry frost, and shall flow as useless water. While there are many other parallels between Egypt and Israel, which have been made by Solomon in his wisdom, here it is clear that the Egyptians had worshipped the things by which Yahweh God had punished them at the time of the Exodus. So that he was indeed mocking both them and their idols. Returning to Exodus, thus far there have been two confrontations between Moses and the Pharaoh. The first, in chapter 5, was a simple plea for him to let the people go off alone to sacrifice to Yahweh in a desert, which the Pharaoh had summarily refused. Then, in the second encounter in chapter 7, the tension became escalated as the magicians of Egypt had been able to match the feet of Aaron's staff, which had turned into a serpent when cast down before Pharaoh. But before Aaron took up his staff again, it had eaten all of the serpents produced by the staffs of the magicians. Now we shall continue with Exodus chapter 7. And a third confrontation, which marks the beginning of the plagues of Egypt. And we're in verse 14 of that chapter. And Yahweh said unto Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Get thee unto Pharaoh in the morning. He goeth out unto the water, and thou shalt stand by the river's brink against he come. That's a really, difficult clause there. And the rod which was turned to a serpent shalt thou take in thine hand. And where we read, and thou shalt stand by the river's brink against he come. Wow. The New American Standard Bible has, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And Brenton Septuagint, and thou shalt meet him on the bank of the river. Either of which clauses are far more understandable. I don't know how the King James Version did that. Okay. And thou shalt say unto him, Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, has sent me unto thee, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, hitherto thou wouldest not hear. Thus saith Yahweh, in this thou shalt know that I am Yahweh. Behold, I will smite with the rod, that is in mine hand upon the waters, which are in a river, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that is in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loathe to drink of the water of the river. There are some schools, such as the Jewish Schechter Institute in Jerusalem, which claim that blood is a late addition to the text here. Jews are also always trying to dismantle the Bible. And that the plague was actually only a plague of fish, which would force major revisions to the text. There is no authentic basis for this claim. Doing so, they take advantage of the fact that in Hebrew, the word for blood is DM, dam, while the word for fish is DG, or dag. And we see that dag in the fish god Dagon, the fish god of many Syrians and Philistines. But the changes to the text would have needed to be far greater than a manipulation of a single letter. They also claim that these revisions had occurred at a very early time, before any of our earliest manuscript evidence. But as early as the 78th and 105th Psalm, there is testimony that the rivers or waters of Egypt had been turned into blood. Speaking of the Egyptians, we read from the 105th Psalm, from verse 25. He turned their heart to hate his people, to deal subtly with his servants. His people, they would be Israel, and his servants would be Israel. It's a Hebraism. It's a parallelism. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. He showed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. He sent darkness and made it dark, and they rebelled not against his word. He turned their waters into blood and slew their fish. Their land brought forth frogs in abundance in the chambers of their kings. He spoke, and there came divers sorts of flies and lice in all their coasts. He gave them hail for rain and flaming fire in their land. He smote their vines and also their fig trees, and broke the trees of their coasts. He spoke, and locusts came, and caterpillars, and that without number, and did eat up all the herbs in their land, and devoured the fruit of their ground. He smote also all the firstborn in their land, the chief of all their strength. He brought them forth also with silver and gold, and there was not one feeble person among their tribes, meaning Israel. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the fear of them fell upon them. So that's the 105th Psalm, going through these plagues and basically explaining them just as they are in the book of Exodus, especially the river, the waters which turned into blood and which slew their fish. Blood and fish have to be two different things there. It can't be fish and fish. So it was more than just the Nile River which had been turned into blood, but all the waters of Egypt, which is also found here in Exodus chapter 7, from verse 19. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, "Say unto Aaron, take thy rod, and stretch out thine hand upon the waters of Egypt, upon their streams, upon their rivers, and upon their ponds, and upon all their pools of water, that they may become blood, and that there may be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone." Now, if all those things were fish, the Egyptians would have just cooked them, I guess. And Moses and Aaron did so, as Yahweh commanded. And he lifted up the rod and smote the waters that were in the river, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the waters that were and the river would turn to blood. And the fish that was in the river died, and the river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink of the water of the river. And there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Neither did he hearken unto them, as Yahweh had said. And Pharaoh turned and went into his house, neither did he set his heart to this also. And all the Egyptians digged round about the river for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the river. And 7 days were fulfilled after that Yahweh had smitten the river. Notice that the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments, indicating that they could also make the water appear as blood. And apparently, seeing that they could perform the feat, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. But it is evident that they could not undo that which Yahweh had done and restore the water so that it could be used by the people. And that alone renders their magic tricks useless. Soon, the magician shall admit defeat. But even then, the Pharaoh will not relent. Here, we also are told that the duration of this plague was 7 days, which must have caused some suffering in the land of Egypt. But we are not told the duration of all these plagues or of the extent of intervening time. Altogether, they seem to have passed rather quickly, over a period of a couple months at the most. Typically, there was an annual flooding of the Nile River from July to October, which was a season of heavy rains to the south and the sources of the river in Ethiopia and modern Uganda. In Ethiopia, Lake Tana is the source for the branch of the river called the Blue Nile. And Lake Victoria, much further to the south, in Uganda, modern Uganda, Zimbabwe perhaps, or no, that's wrong too, Rhodesia, I believe, in British colonialism. I should probably want to call it Rhodesia. Okay, Lake Victoria is the source for the branch called the White Nile. And those two branches merge in Sudan before flowing northwards into Egypt. From Egypt, the appearance of the star Sirius in the south marked the start of the new year and forewarned of the annual flooding event. So the flood season regulated the agricultural season in Egypt. The Egyptians had an idol god, Hapi for real, H-A-P-I, which was the personification of this flood and believed to have been the spirit of the Nile River, and this idol would be mocked by this plague. Let me say I was investigating things. When I was investigating this yesterday to get it right, I saw that Cairo in Egypt is almost the same latitude as where I live near Panama City Beach, Florida. It's almost precisely the same latitude. So I checked when Sirius would rise at each location on the southern horizon, because we don't see it in the winter, in the late winter and spring or early summer. So Sirius rises in Panama City Beach on August 3rd this year. I'll be looking for it. No, I already missed it. I'm sorry. I already missed it. I'm sorry. I'm thinking it's not August 3rd yet. But no, it rises August 1st in Egypt. But evidently, 3,500 years ago, Sirius rose at a time of year which would be considered earlier on our calendars. There are things like precession of the equinoxes and things like that that slowly change the times of the rising and setting of stars and constellations that cannot be seen all year. So we only see Sirius part of the year. I don't know if Sirius can even be seen at all from the northern United States. I don't know. Just like we don't see the lights at the North Pole from Florida normally. But you have to go to the northern United States to see those, I believe. Northwest, perhaps. I don't know if you have to go all the way to Alaska. I'm not sure. I've never been to any of those places. Okay. So when Sirius came, that was the Egyptian New Year, and they knew the flood season would come. When the flood season was over, they planted. So the flood season was followed by a planting season beginning in November, and a harvest season, which was typically from March to June. That figures importantly in timing the duration of these plagues, and also showing that the Exodus really did happen sometime around the beginning of April. Since the Passover seems to have been coincided with the vernal equinox, the vernal equinox plus 15 days, or I think it's 15 days. Here it seems that we must be in the planting season, and perhaps late in that season, as the water was at its lowest level in the time of the harvest. However, by the time of the plague of hail in Exodus chapter 9, it must be in the beginning of the harvest season, which we learn in the description of the plague of hail, where we read, in verse 31 of Exodus chapter 9, "And the flax and the barley was smitten, for the barley was in the ear, and the flax was bold. But the wheat and the rye were not smitten, for they were not yet grown up." So in this, it is evident that the harvest may not yet have begun here. At this point in the plagues, as the start of the harvest season must have been hampered by the first of these plagues. Probably hard to harvest when your water is all turned to blood, and as frogs cover the land and things like that. So the flax and the barley were destroyed in the fields. Therefore, we must interpret the plagues of Egypt as having happened on a more compressed schedule, only lasting no more than a couple of months. By the time of the plague of hail, the planting must have been finished, and the flax and barley were already ready for harvest, a harvest which had evidently not yet started. The only other plague for which we have a duration is the three-day plague of darkness, which had preceded the last plague, the death of the firstborn, which occurred on the same night as the Passover, after which the children of Israel had departed from Goshen. Entering chapter 8, the plague of frogs is the second plague, and seems to have been very brief. So once the Pharaoh refused to relent after the plague of blood, we read, "And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, Go unto Pharaoh, and say unto him, Thus saith Yahweh, Let my people go, that they may serve me. And if thou refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all thy borders with frogs. And the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into thine house, and into thine bedchamber, and upon thy bed, and into the house of thy servants, and upon thy people, and into thine ovens, and into thine kneading troughs. And the frogs shall come up both on thee, and upon thy people, and upon all thy servants." And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, Say unto Aaron, stretch forth thine hand with thy rod over the streams, over the rivers, and over the ponds, and cause frogs to come up upon the land of Egypt. And Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up, and covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians did so with their enchantments, and brought up frogs upon the land of Egypt. At this time, it is not made evident how it could be even noticed that the magicians were able to summon up frogs from the river if frogs had already covered the land. The same could be said for the blood. But in any event, the abilities of the magicians seems to end here. And once again, there is no word of even trying to reverse what Yahweh had done. So while it seems that the Pharaoh had not mentioned Moses, had not petitioned Moses to lift the plague of blood, and it lasted 7 days, here he does break somewhat and petition him to lift the plague of frogs. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat Yahweh that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may do sacrifice unto Yahweh. And Moses said unto Pharaoh, glory over me when I shall entreat for thee and for thy servants and for thy people to destroy the frogs from thee and thy houses, that they may remain in the river only? And he said, tomorrow. And he said, be it according to thy word. Moses said, be it according to thy word, that thou mayest know that there is none like unto Yahweh our God. And the frogs shall depart from thee, and from thy houses, and from thy servants, and from thy people. They shall remain in the river only. Moses himself called the lifting of the plague. And it must by now have been, he must have by now been confident that Yahweh would uphold his words. But Yahweh did not withdraw the frogs. Rather, he had them die. And that was evidently a bigger mess for the Egyptians to suffer. We get a lot of toads on our property in the late summer months. They're downstairs now, probably hopping all over the place, eating bugs on the cement foundation under my house. And if they all died, it would probably make a big stinky mess. Yeah. And Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh. And Moses cried unto Yahweh because of the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh. And Yahweh did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses, out of the villages, and out of the fields. And they gathered them together upon heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his heart, and hearkened not unto them, as Yahweh had said. Inquiring as to whether the ancient Egyptians drank blood, or otherwise had used blood improperly, there was a mixed bag of results. The ancient Egyptian idol goddess Sekhmet was said to have been so bloodthirsty that she nearly destroyed all humanity, until the sun god idol, Re, dyed beer to make it look like blood, and got Sekhmet drunk and ended her rampage. So the ancient Egyptians had a drunken festival with similarly colored beer and wine in order to commemorate that event. But the Egyptians did worship certain fish, and primarily Abtu and Anet, two fish which were said to protect the boat or the sun bark of Ra or Re as the idol crossed the sky each day and entered into the netherworld. The sun itself was seen as Re crossing the sky, and he imagined that it crossed the sky in a sun bark, in a boat, to enter the netherworld each evening. These fish were portrayed in art as native tilapia fish and were esteemed as having been sacred to Re, the sun god, and also to have been one of his manifestations. So the plague of blood killed the fish of the Nile, which was the original native habitat of tilapia fish. Egyptians also worshipped frogs in the form of the frog goddess Heket, H-E-K-E-T or H-E-Q-E-T, either way. Heket was said to have personified regeneration, rebirth, and fertility, and was portrayed as either a frog with the head of a woman or a woman with the head of a frog. There was also an Egyptian idol god called Kek, who is sometimes portrayed with the head of a frog, but sometimes a cat, who is associated with darkness or night. So the plague of frogs seems to have ended quickly, even if it must have taken a while for the Egyptians to clean up the mess. But Yahweh once again hardened the heart of the Pharaoh, which would remain hardened until he made a full example of the Egyptians. Towards that end, there is now a plague of lice. And Yahweh said unto Moses, "Say unto Aaron, stretch out thy rod and smite the dust of the land, that it might become lice throughout all the land of Egypt." And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand with the rod and smote the dust of the earth, and it became lice in man and in beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And the magicians did so with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice upon man and upon beast. Then the magician said unto Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." And Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he hearkened not unto them, as Yahweh had said. In the pagan Egyptian theology, Atum-Re, the sun god, was the original god and bore Shu and Tefnut miraculously. These in turn bore Nut, the sky god, and Geb, the earth god. Here many commentators have associated the lice, which were seen as pests in Egypt, with Geb, since the lice had come out of the dust of the earth. And this is plausible, since the lice themselves were certainly not worshipped in Egypt. The magicians of Egypt could not repeat the plague of lice, and therefore they were compelled to admit that the plagues coming upon Egypt were sent by God, or by a god from their perspective, and by that they acknowledged that the God of Moses was greater than themselves. So they admitted that to Pharaoh, and he wouldn't have it. Now, as the chapter continues, it is not immediately clear that the lice have departed. They probably did. And we read, "And Yahweh said unto Moses, rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh. Lo, he cometh forth to the water. And say unto him, thus saith Yahweh, let my people go, that they may serve me. Else, if thou wilt not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies upon thee, and upon thy servants, and upon thy people, and into thy houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground whereon they are. And I will sever in that day the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, to the end thou mayest know that I am Yahweh in the midst of the earth. And I will put a division between my people and thy people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. And Yahweh did so, and there came a grievous swarm of flies into the house of Pharaoh and into his servants' houses and into all the land of Egypt. The land was corrupted by reason of the swarm of flies. Perhaps on account of their perceived persistence. Flies were symbols of military prowess in Egypt. The pharaohs had awarded soldiers with fly pendants to reward achievements. Necklaces decorated with amulets in the form of flies were worn as symbols of protection. There is a surviving record from an 18th dynasty soldier whom Thutmose I had awarded with quite a few items, among which were 6 golden flies. A fly pendant was even found in the tomb of a queen buried at Thebes. So while perhaps flies were not worshipped, and there is no fly god which can be readily identified, they were nevertheless esteemed for their characteristics, and regardless of how filthy they actually are, they became symbols which had evidently been worn with pride. In the closing verses of Exodus chapter 8, Pharaoh once again calls Moses and seems to relent, telling them to go sacrifice to their God, but Moses challenges him. And Moses said, "It is not meet to do so, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to Yahweh our God. Lo, we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes. And will they not stone us? We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to Yahweh our God as he shall command us." And that response by Moses, that Israel would sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, was made in response to a statement of Pharaoh that they would be allowed to go, but with an admonition stating, "Only ye shall not go very far away," while begging Moses to lift the plague of flies. So Moses agreed on the basis of having a 3 days journey, under the pretense that Israel would not be stoned if the Egyptians did not witness them sacrificing their abominations. And we read in verse 31, and the closing passage of the chapter. "And Yahweh did according to the word of Moses, and removed the swarms of flies from the Pharaoh, from his servants, and from his people. There remained not one. And Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also, neither would he let the people go." And where the swarm of flies is said to have ended, it is evident that although the end of the swarm of lice is not mentioned, the infestation of lice must have also ended by this time. Of course, more plagues would be necessary before Egypt was truly humbled. And even after that, it is apparent that this Pharaoh himself would never be entirely humbled, no matter his losses. However, he would have to live for as long as another 25 years, ruling over a debilitated Egypt, an Egypt whose gods and magicians had been disgraced, whose people had been impoverished. And maybe that was a sufficient punishment. Moving on to Exodus chapter 9, the plague seemed to become even more grievous as their food supply becomes even more greatly diminished. Then Yahweh said unto Moses, I'm sorry, my voice is froggy. It's not a plague of frogs. Then Yahweh said unto Moses, Go in unto Pharaoh and tell him, thus saith Yahweh God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For thou refuse to let them go, and will hold them still. Behold, the hand of Yahweh is upon thy cattle which is in the field, upon the horses, upon the asses, upon the camels, upon the oxen, and upon the sheep. There shall be a very grievous murrain. And Yahweh shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt. And there shall nothing die of all that is the children's of Israel. And Yahweh appointed a set time, saying, tomorrow Yahweh shall do this thing in the land. And Yahweh did that thing on the morrow, and all the cattle of Egypt died. But of the cattle of the children of Israel died not one. And Pharaoh sent, and behold, there was not one of the cattle of the Israelites dead. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. The Egyptian idol god Apis was depicted with the head of a bull, and to him were attributed the realms of fertility, agriculture, and the royal power of the king. So that there are definite parallels to the Canaanite idols called Baal. So here the power of both the Pharaoh and the God who supposedly provides his power are both mocked. And Egypt also loses a lot of its potential food supply, as it had already lost much of its grain and its fish. There were no Chinese fish farms exporting sewage-fed tilapia in those days. Now Yahweh responds again to the insolence of the Pharaoh. And Yahweh said unto Moses and unto Aaron, take to you handfuls of ashes of the furnace, and let Moses sprinkle it toward the heaven in the sight of the Pharaoh. And it shall become small dust in all the land of Egypt, and shall be a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and upon beast throughout all the land of Egypt. And they took ashes of the furnace and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses sprinkled it up toward heaven. And it became a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and upon beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils. For the boil was upon the magicians and upon all the Egyptians. And Yahweh hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he hearkened not unto them, as Yahweh had spoken to Moses. Hear the disgrace of the magicians of Egypt, who had evidently enjoyed great esteem up to the point of the plague of frogs, must have been greatly exacerbated. Not only could they no longer equal the achievements of the God of Moses, but now they themselves were personally stricken with reproach and could not even stand before Moses. While they had already admitted their defeat to Pharaoh, now their defeat is fully manifest before all, yet Pharaoh will still not relent. Of course, this plague would continue to challenge the Egyptian gods of healing, And since it was portrayed as having begun with the dust, the god of the earth as well, which is the source of dust. But the dust came from a furnace, and Sekhmet, the goddess idol of war and destruction, who is also one of the healing goddesses of Egypt, was also a goddess of fire. Sekhmet was portrayed with the head of a lioness, but power over fire was attributed to other idols, including Re, the sun god, and Wadjet, an idol goddess portrayed with the head of a serpent. However, in early Old Kingdom Egypt, a serpent god named Denwen was also depicted as a fiery dragon and had power over fire. That, however, is an interpretation which is contested by at least some modern academics. I have a link to a paper in the footnotes. Now we have seen six plagues upon Egypt. The plagues of blood, frogs, lice, flies, dead beasts, and boils. There are four plagues yet remaining. And what follows is the plague of hail mingled with fire, which Solomon had used so many words to describe in chapter 16 of his wisdom, as we've already read most of that chapter. And Yahweh said unto Moses, "Rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh, and say unto him, Thus saith Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For I will at this time send all my plagues upon thine heart, and upon thy servants, and upon thy people, that thou mayest know that there is none like me in all the earth. For now I will stretch out my hand, that I may smite thee and thy people with pestilence, and thou shalt be cut off from the earth. And in very deed, for this cause I have raised thee up, for to show in thee my power, and that my name may be declared throughout all the earth." Here Yahweh is telling Pharaoh that he raised him up so that he could bring him down, using him to make an exposition of his own power. Of course, it is spoken of many men in Scripture who were explicitly raised up by Yahweh for one purpose or another. And the same could be said for all men and women, no matter how small or great the purpose. But this Pharaoh had a great purpose, even though it is not any purpose which he himself may have ever imagined. Earlier in this series of commentaries on Exodus, we had already spoken of the long reign and great military accomplishments which this Pharaoh had already enjoyed, and how he had come to rule over more territory than Egypt would ever rule again, and which Egypt had ever ruled in the past. So he had a great reason to be proud, and his pride was the ultimate cause of the destruction of his empire. Before the Exodus, Egypt held territory and vassal states as far north as Lebanon, Syria, and the Euphrates River. After the Exodus, with a few small exceptions, it is apparent that Egypt would not extend its power outside of its own borders again in any significant manner for over 100 years, in the time of Ramses II and his successor Merneptah in the last decades of the 13th century BC. But they never made any permanent gains to elevate the state of Egypt anywhere near what it had been under Thutmose III. Now the plague of hail is announced. And the account is concise, because Yahweh is instructing Moses. And Moses is reported as having proceeded. But perhaps a repeat account of Moses relaying the message to Pharaoh would have been repetitive and superfluous. So we read from verse 17. And this is still Exodus chapter 9. As yet, exaltest thou thyself against my people, that I will not let them go? Behold, tomorrow about this time, I will cause it to rain a very grievous hail, such as has not been in Egypt since the foundation thereof, even until now. Send therefore now, and gather thy cattle, and all that thou hast in the field. For upon every man and beast which shall be found in the field, and shall not be brought home, the hail shall come down upon them, and they shall die. He that feared the word of Yahweh among the servants of Pharaoh made his servants and his cattle flee into the houses. And he that regarded not the word of Yahweh left his servants and his cattle in the field. And Yahweh said unto Moses, stretch forth thine hand toward heaven, that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, upon man and upon beast, and upon every herb of the field, throughout the land of Egypt. And Moses stretched forth his rod toward heaven, and Yahweh sent thunder and hail, and the fire ran along upon the ground. And Yahweh rained hail upon the land of Egypt. So there was hail, and fire mingled with the hail, very grievous, such as there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. And the hail smote throughout all the land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast. And the hail smote every herb of the field, and broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. Those trees in the field must have been fruit trees, olives, and things like that. This hail and fire mingled with the hail was a marvel to Solomon and a wonder that elements so contrary to one another could work together in such a manner. Hailstorms occur quite regularly in North America, although only a handful of people have actually ever been killed by them. In 1970, in Coffeyville, Kansas, a hailstorm produced one stone, which was reportedly 17 and a half inches in diameter and weighed 1 2/3 pounds. Other storms have produced hailstones nearly as large. Since then, since 1970, I have sudden gas issues. I'm sorry. I don't know why. Since 1970, many hailstorms have caused billions of dollars in property damage in various North American cities, reporting baseball and softball-sized stones. In earlier ages, in 9th century India, a hailstorm is said to have killed several hundred religious pilgrims. In the 14th century, 1,000 English soldiers are said to have been killed by a hailstorm outside of Chartres, France. Chartres. I'm probably butchering that. Chartres. Maybe Chartois or something crazy like that. In late 15th century China, more than 10,000 deaths were caused by an event which was not known to have been from a hailstorm or from a comet which had broken up in the atmosphere. In India in 1888, a hailstorm with stones as large as oranges reportedly caused 230 deaths and killed 1,600 unfortunate sheep and goats. In 1986, 92 deaths resulted in a hailstorm said to have produced stones the size of grapefruits, which weighed about a kilogram each. Another hailstorm in China in 2002 killed 25 and injured hundreds. The earth opens its mouth to help the woman. In ancient Egypt, Tefnut was the idol goddess of rain, water, and moisture. And here the Egyptians had once again suffered at the hands of what they had worshipped. Tefnut was also depicted as a woman with the head of a lioness. Today, white men and women often suffer at the hands of the beasts that they worship, generally on television and in movies. And more often than not, those beasts which they worship as they play sports and wear shirts that say lions. But here it is evident that if in historical times, hailstorms have sometimes caused the deaths of many hundreds of people out in the open, such as the English soldiers at Chartres or Chartois, that here in Egypt, it would have killed many more men and beasts caught out in the fields, as the word of Yahweh had attested in relation to this plague. Where Pharaoh had responded to this plague, he seems to have been repentant, but then as it turned out, and the plague was lifted, he rather quickly became recalcitrant once again. And Pharaoh sent and called for Moses and Aaron and said unto them, I have sinned this time. Yahweh is righteous. I and my people are wicked. Entreat Yahweh, for it is enough that there should be no more mighty thunderings in hail, and I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. And Moses said unto him, as soon as I am gone out of the city, I will spread abroad my hands unto Yahweh, and the thunder shall cease, neither shall there be any more hail, that thou mayest know how that the earth is Yahweh's. But as for thee and thy servants, I know that you will not yet fear Yahweh God. At this point, there is another indication of the time of year that the flax and barley were ready to harvest and had not been harvested. But the wheat and rye were not really damaged as they required much more time and were probably harvested in June, closer to the end of the harvest season. In verse 31, and the flax and the barley was smitten, for the barley was in the ear and the flax was bald. But the wheat and the rye were not smitten, for they were not grown up. And Moses went out of the city from Pharaoh and spread abroad his hands unto Yahweh. And the thunders and hail ceased, and the rain was not poured upon the earth. And when the Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunders were ceased, he sinned yet more and hardened his heart, he and his servants. And the heart of the Pharaoh was hardened, neither would he let the children of Israel go, as Yahweh had spoken by Moses. And here the wheat and the rye seem not even to have sprouted. But if they had, they will not survive the next plague as we enter into Exodus chapter 10, where there is a plague of locusts, the eighth plague upon Egypt. And Yahweh said unto Moses, go in unto Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I might show these my signs before him, and that thou mayest tell in the ears of thy son and of thy son's son what things I have wrought in Egypt, and my signs which I have done among them, that ye may know that I am Yahweh. And Moses and Aaron came in unto Pharaoh, and said unto him, thus saith Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, how long wilt thou refuse to humble thyself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me. Else, if thou refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow will I bring locusts into thy coast, and they shall cover the face of the earth. That's the face of the land of Egypt, not the whole planet. That one cannot be able to see the earth, and they shall eat the residue of that which is escaped, which remains unto you from the hail, and shall eat every tree which groweth for you out of the field. And they shall fill thy houses, and the houses of all thy servants, and the houses of all the Egyptians, which neither thy fathers nor thy fathers' fathers have seen, since the day that they were upon the earth unto this day. And he turned himself and went out from Pharaoh. And here Yahweh has assured Moses that reports of the wonders of Egypt would be passed down from generation to generation. So it is very likely that Solomon, in his recounting of the plagues of Egypt, had such lore passed on to him through David, since he was only about 500 years removed from these events. But now the courtesans of the Egyptians, which also must have included the failed magicians, and who cannot countenance the God of Moses, grow weary of the messenger instead. In verse 7, Exodus chapter 10. And Pharaoh's servants said unto him, how long shall this man be a snare unto us? As if Yahweh really needed Moses. Let the men go, that they may serve Yahweh their God. Knowest thou not yet that Egypt is destroyed? And Moses and Aaron were brought again unto Pharaoh. And he said unto them, go serve Yahweh your God. But who are they that shall go? And Moses said, we will go with our young and with our old, with our sons and with our daughters, with our flocks and with our herds we will go. For we must hold the feast unto Yahweh. And he said unto them, let Yahweh be so with you, as I will let you go, and your little ones, look to it, for evil is before you. Not so, go now, ye that are men, and serve Yahweh, for that ye did desire. And they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence. And Yahweh said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land, even all that the hail has left. The Pharaoh had agreed that Moses could go, but on different terms, which were not satisfactory to Moses and evidently to Yahweh as well. And Moses stretched forth his rod over the land of Egypt, and Yahweh brought an east wind upon land all that day and all that night. That means the locusts would be coming from Arabia. And when it was morning, the east wind brought forth the locusts. And the locusts went up all over the land of Egypt and rested in all the coasts of Egypt. Very grievous were they. Before them there were no such locusts as they, neither after them shall they be such. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so the land was darkened. And they did eat every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left. And there remained not any green thing in the trees or in the herbs of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. There was a minor Egyptian god idol named Senehem, who is believed to have been able to protect fields from locusts and grasshoppers. But this plague, as well as some of the others, would be a much greater reproach to some of the more significant idols of the Egyptians, such as Osiris, the god of agriculture and vegetation, or Nepri, the god of grain, including barley and wheat, and Seth, a god of crops in general. The God of Moses pronounced all of these plagues in advance, announced the end of each plague in advance, and the supposedly great gods of Egypt were absolutely powerless to do anything to resist. So they were only worthy of being objects of ridicule. So once again, the Pharaoh professes repentance. And once again, he cannot find repentance. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron in haste. And he said, I have sinned against Yahweh your God and against you. Now therefore, forgive, I pray thee, my sin only this once, and entreat Yahweh God that he may take away from me this death only. And he went out from Pharaoh and he entreated Yahweh. And Yahweh turned a mighty strong west wind, which took away the locusts and cast them into the Red Sea. There remained not one locust in all the coasts of Egypt. But Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart so that he would not let the children of Israel go. Now we shall encounter the ninth plague of Egypt, the plague of darkness. And we shall also present Solomon's description of that, which is rather interesting because it is more detailed. And Yahweh said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand towards heaven, and there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. And Moses stretched forth his hand toward heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They saw not one another, neither rose any from his place for 3 days. But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. As we suggested earlier, Solomon seems to have known more of the Exodus account than what is recorded. And as Yahweh had said to Moses, there would be accounts passed down from generation to generation of the wonders which happened in Egypt. We had just read that in the opening verses of chapter 10. Yes, I had to go look. That's okay. So as we had recounted most of his perspective on these plagues in Wisdom chapter 16, which we provided here earlier. He continued in chapter 17 and 18 and discussed this plague of darkness at length and also addressed the plague of the firstborn in a mention, more or less. So reading from our own translation of the Wisdom of Solomon, I wouldn't even try the King James Version once I had my own. Okay. For greater are your judgments and hard to explain, for which reason uninstructed souls have wandered. Then the lawless, meaning the Egyptians, having undertaken to oppress the holy nation, which are the children of Israel, of course, captives of darkness and prisoners of a long night, were laid shut up under their roofs, fugitives of eternal providence, for supposing their hidden sins to be unnoticed, with a dim covering of oblivion, being terribly astonished, they were scattered and troubled by hallucinations. And Solomon elaborates on this. However, it is not found in the concise Exodus account. Then neither did the innermost room containing them protect them from fear, but agitating noises sounded around them, and obscure apparitions with gloomy countenances became visible. And indeed, not any power of fire had prevailed to give light, neither did the quite bright flames of stars abide to shine upon that hateful night, the three-day night. Solomon's referring to the entire three-day period as that night, or a long night earlier in this passage. But there only appeared to them a spontaneous fire full of terror, and being terribly frightened, they thought the things being observed worse than that which is not seen. So according to the Wisdom of Solomon, Yahweh had sent dreams and visions among the Egyptians during their 3 days of darkness, which had assisted in their destruction. Here he also speaks of the failures of the magicians, who themselves were made sick, as he says, just as we have seen that they had also been stricken with the plague of boils. But the delusions of magic craft were laid prostrate, and a contentious rebuke of the pretense for wisdom. For they promising to drive away terrors and troubles from a sick soul, themselves were made sick from a ridiculous devotion, their magic and their idolatry. For even if nothing terrible frightened them, in the passing of beasts and hissing of serpents, having been terrified, trembling they had perished, even refusing to look at the air that from no place could be avoided. For cowardly is wickedness condemned by her own witness, and always takes hardships to herself, being afflicted in conscience. The continuing lesson here is that the sinners in Egypt were punished with their own delusions. This evokes the words of Yahweh found in Isaiah chapter 66 in verse 4. I also will choose their delusions and will bring their fears upon them. Because when I called, none did answer. When I spoke, they did not hear, but they did evil before mine eyes and chose that in which I delighted not. So the apostate children of Israel were no better than the hard-hearted Egyptians. Returning to Solomon's description of the plague of darkness. For fear is nothing but a betrayal of the resources of reason, and the expectation from within being weaker considers ignorance better than that which provides the cause of torment. But they, on a night that was actually powerless, and coming upon them from the innermost recesses of powerless Hades, sleeping in the same sleep, while they were persecuted by wonders of phantoms than they were released from life by betrayal. For a sudden and unexpected fear had poured over them, that in that manner indeed, whoever at that time was there falling was garrisoned, having been shut into a prison without iron bars. Now there's an interesting passage in Wisdom referring to one chain of darkness, which seems to explain the idiom as it had been used of the fallen angels in the epistles in Peter and Jude. For whether any man was a husbandman, or a shepherd, or a laborer toiling in a desert, having been overtaken, he awaited that inescapable necessity. For with one chain of darkness they had all been bound. Whether a whistling wind or a musical sound of birds in surrounding widespread branches, or a rhythm of water being driven with a force, or a crash of hard stones being thrown down, or an unobserved course of leaping creatures, or a voice of howling of the roughest beasts, or a sound echoing from the hollow mountains. Being terrified, it undid them. Solomon's going through this list of apparitions which he imagined that they had suffered during this dark night in Egypt. For the whole society shined with bright light and continued in works without disturbance. Over them alone was there spread a heavy night, an image of the darkness about to receive them, but they themselves were more heavy than darkness. And we would assert that being deluded, rejecting God, and being punished with one's own carnal devices, a man is blinded, having been bound in a chain of darkness. This is true whether a man is only a mere apostate or whether he is an actual enemy of God. As Christ said of his adversaries, as it is found in Matthew chapter 15, let them alone. They be blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. References to the plague of darkness continue in Wisdom chapter 18. We will only read one more paragraph. But upon your saints, there was a great light of things, while hearing the voice of them, but not seeing the shape of them. Then because they had not suffered those things, they were blessed. And because they did not injure those having first done wrong, meaning the Israelites did not injure the Egyptians, they gave thanks, and for their differences they begged kindness. In return for which you had provided a flaming pillar, both to be a guide for the unknown journey and a harmless sun for a general hospice. I'm sorry, for a generous hospice, a generous place of rest and retreat. Indeed, the others, worthy to be deprived of light and imprisoned in darkness, having imprisoned your sons confined, by whom the uncorrupt light of the law was about to be given unto the age, and then being determined to slay the infants of the holy ones, then for one child being exposed and saved, referring to Moses, for reproach you have taken away, and a multitude of their children, then with like passion you destroyed in violent water the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. That night being made known beforehand to our fathers, in order that, knowing with certainty, having faith in the oaths, they would rejoice, faith in the oaths which Yahweh had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Evidently, after the 3 days of darkness were completed, Pharaoh appears willing to compromise with Moses once again, But this time Moses is not accepting his offer. So chapter 10 ends where we read from verse 24. And Pharaoh called unto Moses and said, Go ye, serve Yahweh. Only let your flocks and your herds be stayed. Let your little ones go with you also. And Moses said, Thou must give us also sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice unto Yahweh our God. Our cattle also shall go with us. There shall not be a hoof left behind. For thereof we must take to serve Yahweh our God, and we know not with what we must serve Yahweh until we come thither, until we get there. But Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. And Pharaoh said unto him, Get thee from me. Take heed to thyself. See my face no more. For in that day that thou seest my face, thou shalt die. And Moses said, Thou hast spoken well. I will see thy face again no more. And these final words of Exodus chapter 10 are foreboding. And in chapter 10, I'm sorry, in chapter 11, the text is ambiguous as to whether Moses had addressed Pharaoh directly. But in verse 8 we read, And he went out from Pharaoh in great anger, a statement which the Septuagint and other translations also contain. So perhaps there Moses had at least made a broader declaration to the people and servants of Pharaoh, rather than directly addressing the Pharaoh personally. This leaves one final plague, which is yet to come upon Egypt, which is the death of the firstborn of all the Egyptians, immediately followed by the exodus of Israel out of the land. Yahweh willing, we will return for that discussion in the near future. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.